Now we come this evening to the concluding study in the book of Deuteronomy. We're turning to pages 184 and 185 in the Old Testament section. The Good Life is what we call this series. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope that maybe if you want to do some further study, you will take the tape recordings afterwards, work through them, meditate on them. The Good Life. And tonight, the continuing of the good life. So we're looking at Deuteronomy 31 and 32. I'd like to read the first four verses of Moses' song there in Deuteronomy 32. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak. And let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as the gentle rain upon the tender grass, and as the showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His work is perfect. There have been many great speeches made across the span of history. Alexander the Great and Demosthenes gave some of them. Posterity will remember President Lincoln's Gettysburg speech of November 1863, or Martin Luther King a century later. Joan of Arc knew how to move crowds. So did Kate Booth of the Salvation Army. But I suggest to you that leaving aside the preaching of Jesus Christ, who stands alone, no speech ever given has eclipsed the farewell swan song of Moses, prophet and leader of Israel, over 30 centuries ago. He's risen from his hiding place as a baby in the bulrushes, through adoption in the court of the pharaohs of Egypt, to his subsequent flight to Midian, and then to be the divinely appointed statesman, lawgiver of the Old Testament people of God. What was Moses? Well, he was the masterminder of the exit from Egyptian oppression, negotiator of the Red Sea crossing, pioneer of the wilderness and Sinai experience, exponent of the Ten Commandments. Moses has seen off the battlefield as well, Korah, Sihon, Og, Midian, these various foes. And now poised at the edge of the promised land that he would see but not enter, representing as it did the good life promised by God eternally to all his followers, the great leader prepares the people for a new phase as the Moses saga winds down to its end and the handover takes place. How then to ensure that the great lessons learned out there in the wilderness would be passed on and the future be secured? What was to last? What could last as Moses went to his grave and Joshua's military commander took over? These concluding words of Moses put the picture graphically and, I think, as movingly as any speech ever given. How to continue? What lasts? The Apostle Paul, 1,000 and more years later, contemplated the same issues in an equally moving farewell address at Ephesus when he said in Acts 20, verse 29, I know that after my departure, fierce wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among your own selves will arise those speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them. Therefore be alert. Well, it's the same here. Look at Deuteronomy 31 and those opening sentences. Have a look. Don't look at me. Look at the Bible. There's Moses. He's had 40 years growing up, 40 years leading Israel out of Egypt and through the wilderness, 40 years preparing her for the next step, Jordan and the good land. He's speaking as a dying man to people he's saying goodbye to. And how to continue the good life? What will last? Well, it's our issue too, of course. How to keep going and how to keep growing in faith and in vibrant discipleship, in the spiritual appetite? How do we maintain it here in this city? The moment we think that we have left the learners group, We won't know it, but we've already reached our ceiling. We'll be at a standstill. Moses' words in chapter 31, verse 6, have a timeless relevance about them. Be strong, he says, and of good courage. Do not fear or be in dread of your adversaries, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. How many times has the Bible said that? How then to continue? What lasts? Moses, especially in his song of chapter 32, refers several times to God as the rock. Take that away, and of course nothing lasts. So what was there about the person and work of God that the people of Israel could hold on to as they faced a very uncertain future? First, there were the unshakable laws. Moses tells Joshua in verses 7 and 8 to be strong, and then, do you see it there in verses 9 to 13, he hands over the written divine law to the priests. It's the framework for the whole life of Israel. They will refer to it regularly, of course, but every 7 years, as verse 10 says, the laws of the Lord in their entirety were to be read in the public hearing of every single man, woman, and child of Israel. Later in the chapter, from verses 24 to 26, he tells the priests to place the book of the law beside the covenant box, the ark, as it was called, representing as it did the accompanying presence of God all the time with them. The laws of God were to travel with them everywhere. The rock of the law, why, it was their life, the unshakable laws. Secondly, there was to be the unbroken leadership. You see it here in the same chapter. Joshua is summoned in verse 7 and told to be courageous as he takes over the mantle of Moses. He receives his commission a few verses further on in verses 14 and 15. You see, Moses is about to depart, and it was a crisis. Of course it was. But it always is. I mean, when your beginners group, members of beginners groups here, or your fellowship group requires a new leader, you don't want just anybody. Nor when it's time to elect a new church council, or to choose a church warden, or to find that student team leader. It's a crisis moment every time it happens. And the crisis won't go away until the right person is recognized and seen to be in place. Do you pray for your leaders? You can be sure they pray for you. I try and pray for my leaders, the Bishop of London and the Bishop of Fulham, every day. An awful lot rests on them. And then worldwide, there's a crisis of leadership. It seems with hindsight that too many leaders in politics, industry, yes, and in evangelism as well, were only there for the power kick, for the perks, for the comfortable lifestyle, backed up maybe by a Swiss bank account. And the world has groaned under such parasites. By contrast, the colleagues who traveled and fought alongside Alexander the Great, way back in the labyrinths of time, all knew that he lived no better than they did. He woke earlier, worried harder, and worked more remorselessly than them all. Here's Alexander in one of his great speeches. I have no part of my body in front at least that is left without scars. There is no weapon used at close quarters or hurled from afar of which I do not carry the mark. I have been wounded by the sword, shot with arrows, struck from a catapult, smitten many times with stones and clubs for you, for your glory, for your wealth. That was when he was facing mutiny. Joshua, similarly, had proved himself over the years to be the one to stand in the line of leadership after Moses. Moses, at that point, was colossal. His words in chapter 32, unsurpassed. So we say, what a man to follow. But he hadn't been like that at the start. Remember Moses' words in Exodus 4, verse 10, when he received his commission? Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent. I am slow of speech and of tongue. Then just a few verses after that, "Oh, my Lord, send, I pray, some other person." That's Moses. He grew to be a giant of all civilization. Again and again, the true leader is nervous when the tap on the shoulder comes. It's a good sign to feel nervous. It's part of the qualification to feel unworthy. How then to continue the good life? Well, it's a secret of unshakable principles and laws being established and held onto firmly, limpet-like, and then also of unbroken leadership. That is vital too. Thirdly, there was the uncompromising witness, as I call it. I call it that as I look at various passages in these two chapters. There are the passages where Moses gives God's warnings about Israel's national characteristic of compromising with false ideologies. There it is in chapter 31, verse 16. "Behold, you are about to sleep with your fathers. Then this people will rise and play the harlot after the strange gods of the land where they go to be among them," says God. Retribution would follow as a result, we read. And so the song that Moses is to make public, verse 19, is to warn Israel, I quote, "as a witness for me against the people of Israel." Again, verse 21, "And when many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness." Yes, and those laws that will reside beside the Ark of the Covenant will be there, end of verse 26, "for a witness against you." The prod of God speaking in the conscience nationally to them all was going to be there. Verse 28, "Assemble to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their ears," says Moses, "and call heaven and earth to witness against them. For I know that after my death," this could be Paul speaking, couldn't it? "you will surely act corruptly and turn aside from the way." It's a warning. Idolatry would set in. The grumblers that had always plagued Moses at times would come into ascendancy again and plague Joshua. God's people across the ages have never been without grumblers. It's not just a harmless English fad. Actually, it's a sin. It's classed in 1 Corinthians 10 along with idolatry. Idolatry and grumbling, it says, in the same breath. Joshua would come up against it. Grumbling, what does it do? What's wrong with grumbling? I'll tell you about grumbling. It marks out the backliner from the frontliner. Come to the front line with me. Come on. We'll go and visit Joshua out there, in the front line of all the conflict and the difficulties. Or Alexander the Great, if you like. We come up to the front line. We say to them, "How are you getting on here in the front line?" "Well, it's not too bad. We lost a quarter of our men in the last 10 minutes, but, you know, it's not too bad. We think we can hold this hill. Perhaps you can send up a few arrows from the back. We're running a mite short, but we'll cope. Leave it to us. It's all right." That's the front line. Then we go to the back line, right at the very back. We say, "How are you getting on here?" "Oh, it's awful. Oh, it's terrible. Look at the weather. Food's terrible. Terrible food." And then somebody says, "My tent's leaking as well." Very. That's exactly the difference. Frontliner and the backliner. Grumbling about trivialities. Well, it's just the same in a church. Really, it doesn't matter whether it's the money or the hymns or the temperature. For the uninvolved backliner, something will always be wrong. That's what marks them out. Moses had seen it all. So part of the secret of successful continuity into the promised land, in addition to the unshakable laws and the unbroken leadership, was this very necessary element of the warning, the uncompromising witness to high standards. That's what he was on about. A tremendous amount was riding on Israel. We have to understand that. As it does on the Christian church today, to remain pure and incorruptible within an extremely corruptible surrounding society. Do we feel the temptations of London? Of course we do. And it's up to us to maintain the witness and the purity and the attractiveness of the Christian life lived in company with Jesus Christ. So that will communicate. It'll communicate together, and it'll communicate on an individual level as well. If Christ has got hold of us, and his word is the governing rudder of our lives day by day, it will communicate. It can do no other. Then a fourth element in continuing the good life, I call it the unforgettable events. As we reach the Song of Moses now in chapter 32, it's full of it. The great emphasis being remember. Moses calls the heavens and the earth to be witnesses of his words, there in verse 1. Then he speaks of the impregnable rock that is God in verse 4. The rock that Israel had sheltered in all those years, that had provided resources when times were low, the rock that represented stability, security, uprightness, unshakableness. Remember, says Moses in verse 7, the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. And the dying Moses recounts for his hearers the saving and sustaining actions of God in the wilderness, as contrasted with the faithful untrustworthiness of Israel. I like verse 10. God found Israel, found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye, protecting Israel. In other words, verse 11, like an eagle with her nest. Do you see the words there? Providing from the rocky ground, verse 13. But with Israel's apostasy, repeatedly, end of verse 15, resulting in the scoffing rejection of the rock of salvation. That was going to be a characteristic. Need not have been, but Moses can see it coming. He warns them. You were, verse 18, unmindful of the rock that begot you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. So Deuteronomy, amongst other things, is a great book of remembrance. Many times we're told, remember. And Moses could foresee a distant generation which, to quote Judges chapter 2 and verse 10, did not know the Lord or the work which he had done for Israel. And that would be the generation where the law of the jungle was going to take over, where authority was gone, where juveniles would run riot, where every person did what was right in his own eyes. Today we call that, in philosophical terms, existentialism. It's as old as the hills of Canaan's land. Remembrance is the antidote. The recalling of the great historical events that build faith and provide a framework and stable reference point for all of life. But without remembrance, the prediction of verse 28 would be fulfilled, as it is in every civilization that has lost its hold on history and its lessons. Do you see verse 28? They are a nation void of counsel, and there is no understanding in them. If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. That is, they would have a sense of destiny. Where are we heading to? And of ultimate purpose. And Moses looks at the aimlessness and the empty philosophies of the surrounding nations, and in the wonderful words of verse 31, explains that even the enemies of the faith pay tribute to the superiority of Israel's faith, whether willingly or indirectly. For their rock is not as our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges of the matter. It's always been true across the whole story of faith that our fiercest critics again and again have had to concede that they haven't got a good alternative. Have you tried that? When you find yourself pinned to the wall by somebody who's arguing against Christianity, don't allow just that to happen. Yours is not the only worldview lying there on the dissecting slab waiting to be dissected. Everybody has a view on life. Everybody. So when somebody criticizes you or me, and we feel a bit pinned to the wall, we must lovingly turn the tables and say, now tell me your alternative. Describe, the word is this, describe to me your own worldview. Not, have you got a worldview? Because everybody does have a worldview. The question we should ask is, please describe to me your worldview, your understanding of the meaning of life. Describe it. Again and again, it'll turn up that their rock is not as our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. Even Bertrand Russell once commented of Christianity, there's nothing to be said against it, except that it is too difficult for most of us to practice sincerely. Perhaps he was in a charitable moment, but he said it. The faith of Israel wasn't only like a rock, it was also like a vine. And Moses compares the vines of the other nations unfavorably in verse 32. For their vine derives, he says, from Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities of destruction. Why are the lessons not learnt? If Britain turned en masse to faith in Jesus Christ, would it be a good thing in the public understanding or a bad thing? We here in church know that it would be a thundering good thing. The difference in our crime statistics, in national morale, in our respect for other people, yes, even in our economy, would be noticeable in 6 weeks. It wouldn't take long. It's because people have forgotten, and because perhaps we have been slow in reminding our friends about the rock of salvation that is God in Jesus Christ. The time of mission ahead of us gives us a fresh, excellent opportunity. Consider the good life and continuing the good life. What was its secret? Fourfold, the unshakable laws and principles, the unbroken leadership for the next generation, the uncompromising witness, and the unforgettable events of salvation that are to be remembered. And finally, the unfading song. There has to be, I think, a factor of inspiration. Why put it into words only if it can also be transmitted to the memory through song? So it's significant that Moses' wonderful words here were to be turned into a song that future generations of Israelites would commit to memory and sing to their children in a way that, well, it might have otherwise got left in the cellar, in the dusty archives, or on inaccessible top shelves. So often music will say it in its own special medium, what any number of abstruse and erudite speeches, however clever, might not get across in quite the same way. Which is why I hope we can all use that forthcoming Easter Saturday musical event that this church is putting on in the Royal Albert Hall this Easter Saturday, bringing friends to hear and share in music and song the evangelistic victory message of Easter, the resurrection. Same with this mission that we're now heading towards in this next fortnight. Music is a dimension that the believer learns to step into and to use. It's very powerful. In ancient Rome once, there was a clever and learned atheist who arrived in the city, goading its residents with his very convoluted arguments against the existence of God, against there being any purpose in life itself. He picked on an inarticulate shepherd, who was a Christian man, as the target for his razor-like logic as he argued his case in the city square, cutting him down with wit and eloquence. And he ended off with a rhetorical flourish and exclaimed, "What do you say to that?" The shepherd said nothing, took out his flute and began to play a very lively tune. Within minutes, all the people in the square were dancing with joy. They'd forgotten the rhetoric. Finished. I'd love to have heard the music of the Song of Moses. Yes, it lasted all right. The Israelites never forgot it. The Bible has never forgotten it. For what do we find at the Bible's very end in the book of Revelation, chapter 15 and verse 3? These words, speaking of the company of redeemed people across all the centuries who have conquered in the strength of the Lamb, singing in their triumph. And it says, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and wonderful are thy deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, O King of the ages. The song of Moses and of the Lamb, in the end, it's one song, the song of salvation and of God's triumph that universally we sing, of course we do, in the sure confidence that the good life of walking with God with all its tests and tensions is nevertheless the life that men and women were born and ordained for, that nothing else can parallel or match when we really weigh it up. We come to an end, then, of our studies in Deuteronomy with this final challenge, continuing as we began, armed with the secrets of the unshakable laws, the unbroken leadership, we must practice that, the uncompromising witness, the unforgettable events of redemption, and the unfading song that inspires our spirits. And as Moses spoke the final words of chapter 32, to his listeners, I'm sure that he speaks them to us too, in verse 47, of the good life with God. For, he says, it is no trifle for you, but it is your life. Are we not forced to agree? Sure we are. Take that away, and all we're left with is an existential nothingness, each one for themselves, in an aimless urban wilderness.